Clubhouse.
Imagine me and you, I do, I think about you.
Welcome to Pod Clubhouse Film Reviews. I'm Mike, and tonight we're talking about Epic's two-part series, Laurel Canyon. Tonight we're talking about part one of Laurel Canyon. It's a new music documentary coming to Epic's channel on May 31st, and then the second part drops on June 7th. And joining me to discuss it is Sheila from Pop Culture Review and her husband, John Bavona, who is a professional musician and making his debut here at the Clubhouse. Hey, Sheila. Hey, John. Thanks so much for joining me tonight to talk about Laurel Canyon.
Hey, thanks, Mike, for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us. I appreciate
it. We always love getting new, fresh voices into the Clubhouse. It makes it much more interesting. And honestly, I'm a music fan, a rehabilitated drummer, but I don't think I have the proficiency maybe to fully appreciate everything that we get to see in Laurel Canyon. John, you, as I said, you're a professional musician. Give us a little background on your bona fides.
Sure. I've been a professional musician for about 25 years. During my career, I've been mostly a freelance musician. I've done many things for TV and radio. I've played in several bands and a recording artist as well. So pretty well-rounded. That's why I really enjoyed this show.
You are uniquely qualified. I mean, I know Sheila was a former trombone player in another life, but you are a gigging musician doing it today. When you see something like this, the 60s and the music, what does that mean to you? Does it mean anything? Is this a formative part of music history for you, the 60s?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of things they started doing then paved the way for the next generation of musicians, especially the harmony vocals and songwriting just paved the way for a lot of the newer artists that were influenced by them. So absolutely.
We're all about the same age. I came to 60s and 70s music late, but did you grow up listening to The Byrds and Crosby, Stills and Nash and The Mamas and the Papas, all those kinds of folk music, folk rock and roll acts that we're talking about here in Laurel Canyon? Was that part of your music growing up that you listened to, or just kind of happened upon it later in life?
To be completely honest, it was just before my influences, mostly. As I got older, I definitely went back, and I'm very familiar with those acts, of course. But it wasn't in my wheelhouse. It wasn't my influences. It was just a little before my time. But I have a great appreciation. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a big fan of the vocal harmonies that those acts made famous.
And we certainly see that in this part one. We see a lot of the harmonies. How about you, Sheila? What's your relationship to this era of music, this late 60s move away from folk music into folk rock music?
I kind of came to the 60s music a little bit later as well. You know, it was more in high school. Like, we were just like teenagers driving around listening to The Doors and Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin, you know, because the music on the radio was a bit shitty in the mid-90s, hearkening back to a time where music was really good. And Mike and I have been friends for a long time, and we were in those high school bands together, discovering a lot of different music. So I would say I was more of like a 15, 16, 17 year old kind of coming to this era of music and really developing an appreciation for it. That's part of the reason why I was drawn to this Epic series.
Same for me. I think I'm actually right in the same wheelhouse as you guys. I was aware of this music. I know it. I enjoy it. I was grooving along to the soundtrack of this first episode the entire time, but this was not really my scene. I think I probably start with The Doors, but I go really back as far as like the 70s. I was much more influenced and into what became like the 70s classic rock sound, The Who, Led Zeppelin, you know, being a favorite.
And those are exactly my influences as well, all the acts that you just mentioned. By all means, being a guitar player, someone like Jimi Hendrix has a huge, huge influence. But outside of that, I also like The Doors. But outside of that, I agree with what you said, with the 70s being the cornerstone for me also.
There's a great part in here where it was someone from The Byrds was talking about going to play at the Troubadour. He was going to plug in his guitar, and the owner of the club comes running down and says, "What the fuck are you doing?" He's like, "This is a folk music club." Yeah, this is, you know, acoustic music. And there's a lot of that kind of clash that's happening right at this time. You have these acoustic guitars that are coming out of the straight folk music sound that are now becoming folk rock music, but right behind folk rock music is electric rock music. You're at like the dawn of the Jimi Hendrix age. And this series is really dealing with that 3-4 year period where there was like really straddling those two kind of eras, you know, where it got cranked up loud and it was really hard rocking electric guitar music, the very Americana sound of like folk music. This struck me because it seemed like such a very specific time in American music that, you know, I don't know that you could ever recreate again. How about Laurel Canyon itself? That's the name of the series, and in a lot of ways, it's the heart of what they're talking about here. You guys ever heard of Laurel Canyon as being this artist enclave of so much of the music from this time? Sheila, was this anything that you even knew existed?
I kind of knew it was out there. I mean, I knew it was a place. I knew it was a thing. I didn't know it was a niche where like these creative minds kind of really came together and gelled, and sort of the organicness of what came out of it, the forming of the different bands and the collaborations and the parties. I had no idea, but dude, I would have liked to have been alive in 1968 to have hung out in like Frank Zappa's basement or something.
How about you, John? Laurel Canyon, does that name, when you hear it before watching this, did that mean anything to you at all?
I had heard of it, of course, but I didn't know the extent of what took place there. As an artist, I found myself really honestly jealous of having an environment like that, that, you know, 24/7, it was just all these great artists living in a small area where everyone just knew everyone, and everyone, it was just free, and different artists coming together, writing all day, coming up with ideas and sharing with different artists. I really did. I found myself jealous of wanting to be in a Laurel Canyon, a place where artists can be like that.
It's tremendous when you think about it. It's one of those things that I'm sure at the time they probably couldn't appreciate the density of talent in such a small area.
Sure.
But looking back on it now, I mean, this was a commune, essentially, of right. just the brightest minds in American music for this period. And again, very small period of time. You know, the subheading of this series, if you caught it at the beginning, it's Laurel Canyon. It's Laurel Canyon, and it says A Place in Time. I think that's a really apt title because it is just this small segment in this small area, but it had worldwide repercussions. The acts that we see here really defined a whole age. I mean, they defined a political movement, the counterculture, the protest songs. That's all here. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it. Let's talk about the plot, to the extent that there's a plot and a narrative. So this was directed by Alison Elwood, who I haven't seen any of her work. I know she's done some music documentaries before. She's probably most famous for another doc she did called American Jihad. The basic through line here is that by using the stories of Henry Diltz, Nurit Wild, and Elliot Roberts, Henry and Nurit being photographers from the time, who just happened to capture photos of all of these artists gathered in this one place in Laurel Canyon, and Elliot Roberts being a manager of Joni Mitchell, and then eventually of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and some other artists of the time, through them acting kind of as moderators, we learn about the web of people who kind of came to Laurel Canyon, musicians mostly, and how they one by one were kind of all drawn there. A would bring B, B would bring C, and then by the time you knew it, you were down to like Z of artists. And they all kind of followed each other into this area and really created, like John said, this enclave of artists that for a small period of time just transformed American music. They took it from acoustic folk music into this folk rock music with a political bent. When you think of acts like the Mamas and the Papas, Buffalo Springfield, do you think of the counterculture, the protest songs? Is that what kind of jumps out at you?
It definitely reminds me of it, yes. It's kind of like the narration of a period of time. You connect music with experiences. Music has an amazing way of transforming you to a place in time. I'm sure there's many listeners out there, if they hear a song on the radio, it brings them right back to a moment in their own lives. Let it be positive or negative, music has that amazing ability to do that to people. So yes, I think it definitely a narration for a place of time.
How about you, Sheila? When you listen to this music, what springs to your mind versus what we saw here in the interconnectedness of these artists? Did they match together, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like this, like you said, this is a period of time and there was such tumult going on in the world. You know, the Vietnam War was in its hot zone. You know, we're talking like, you know, the late 60s here. There was actually like a protest just down the hill from Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles. It was a protest against fascist notions with the police. You know, the LAPD was doing its LAPD thing. There was some riots and demonstration. And, you know, the band Buffalo Springfield wrote For What It's Worth out of that protest. I thought my entire life that For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield was about the Vietnam War. It was not. It was about the LAPD and just down the road from their house. You know, definitely there's this connection to that notion of, you know, kind of fighting against the system and finding a new voice and breaking apart from the tradition of the old days and finding a new sound. So when you have those clashes, you're definitely going to have, you know, a different outcome. You're going to have something different on the other side of that. That's going to be transformative. That's going to be something that lasts, because it's not just about the one moment in time. It's about a theme that will resonate for years. I mean, we're talking, what, almost 50 years ago. This stuff will over 50 years ago, we're still listening to a lot of the stuff that I was jamming along to in that soundtrack.
It's crazy when you think about it, like that For What It's Worth song, the story of that also was something I didn't know. I, like you, always associated it with it as a Vietnam protest song. And they talk about how the fact that it got kind of co-opted for that in the long run. But hearing from the mouth of the people who made the music, the story of it, that was just one of the kind of nuggets of information I picked up here. And I love music history and music trivia like this. They have a great bit about Mr. Tambourine Man, which I knew Bob Dylan wrote, but I didn't realize he recorded it and didn't like to redo takes. And so when he was told it was off key, he just abandoned the song and let the birds record it, and then ended up really liking their version of it and kind of endorsed it. Like, that was crazy to me. I didn't realize that about Bob Dylan. I didn't realize that about the history of that song. Were there any nuggets of history that jumped out here that either changed what you thought was the truth, or you just didn't even realize the history of it?
You know, so much of the collaboration that came out of the area of Laurel Canyon, sort of being the area and sort of the niche. I had no idea that Crosby, Stills, and Nash kind of sprung up out of, you know, David Crosby's desire to leave the birds. And it was basically them sitting around in a house in Laurel Canyon and they started harmonizing and there you go, bang, bang, bang. We now have a new band that, you know, sought to change the sound. So rather than harmonizing as a band where you're going to bring all the different voices in at their different pitches, they were actually trying to sound like one person singing. So you would have like this large vocal sound, but just the organicness of like how that band that's been so transformative for so much of music and so influential kind of just came out of a living room session where I'm annoyed with my band and they don't want me in there anymore and they're basically going to fire me. Yeah, I don't like my band anymore either, and I'm going to move away from England and for Graham Nash, you know, to leave the Hollies and just become this brand new band. So I loved that, the charm of it, that it was just so natural. There was nothing forced. It was always just like, hey, you know, what's going on here today? And you never know what's going to come out of it. I liked that aspect of it.
I really enjoyed the fact that they didn't sugarcoat it either. The series is presenting the stories in a real matter-of-fact kind of way. You know, they're not portraying Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young to an extent, you know, getting together in some kind of magical concoction of let's make beautiful music together. You just like you said, it grew out of the dysfunction, and there's so much dysfunction here. Like, I like that. I like knowing the real story. It seems more authentic to me. If they just said, well, you know, Stills was just this genius and, you know, Crosby was just drawn to his voice and needed to. No, they were all just pissed off at their own individual bands imploding. How about you, John? What was a nugget you picked up here that you didn't know or just kind of blew you away a little bit?
To have, I don't remember how, in terms of square footage, how large Laurel Canyon actually is. I remember one part when Glenn Frey was singing a song, and one of the managers said to him that you're not really strong enough to be a solo act. You're going to have to put a band around you. And it was great to see from them being Linda Ronstadt's backup band, the Eagles come together, become obviously a historic musical group. I thought that was fantastic.
And that's where you have Henry Stilton and Norbert Weil really on the scene here, mixing and matching with these people as like their equals, taking their pictures, and Henry also being a musician himself with the Modern Folk Quartet. They were there doing it, taking the pictures. But then you had this Elliot Roberts, who just kind of falls into Joni Mitchell, becomes her manager, and starts a management company to represent her, and then recruits David Crosby to record her first album or produce her first album. And then he becomes this manager to Laurel Canyon and winds up with the Eagles as a client also. We'll learn in the next episode. Like, it's wild how all of these people just kind of came together. It's like a sliding doors kind of thing. If they had gone left instead of right, music would have been transformed forever if these people don't wind up together. If Peter Tork doesn't walk nude through someone's house. Jesus Christ, Peter Tork was a nudist. That was crazy to me. I didn't know that.
That was hilarious.
So funny. And I loved all the time that they spent about the Monkees, because the Monkees are such a weird little footnote in history with music. But in Laurel Canyon, they were really important. And like, that's one of those kinds of things. I was thinking about you, John, specifically as a guitarist. Laurel Canyon seems to me, and the best way I think to explain it to people who haven't seen this is, imagine walking out of your house, right? You live on a street, walking out of your house, and you're just kind of going next door and finding someone with a guitar, and you're sitting down, and then the guy across the street from you comes in with a guitar and sits down, and it's just your neighbors. It's just your neighbors. They all kind of walk in. They all have guitars. They all have beautiful voices from God.
Exactly.
And you just create some of the most legendary music ever recorded in American rock and roll. It's insane. It's like, my neighbors are not that talented where I live.
No, mine either. You know, my neighbors usually park too close to my driveway. You know, as I said before, being a musician, being an artist, I found myself many times really jealous that I never got to experience something where Frank Zappa lived down the road to me. If I needed a cup of sugar, I'd grab it from Joni Mitchell. You know, it's amazing.
Even they acknowledged how bizarre it is to have Alice Cooper, Frank Zappa, and Peter Tork all hanging out together.
Sure.
That looks like something where someone took a history, like a snow globe, and just shook it all up and made it look strange. But in Laurel Canyon, it seemed like it all made sense there, which is maybe the beauty of it. Do you guys watch musical documentaries? Do you like documentaries, I guess, is the first question. But two, if so, are you into musical docs? Do they scratch an itch you may have about the music genre?
Well, I am a student of history, so I love anything and everything about history, but particularly music documentaries, I really enjoy. Lately, we've discovered the Reels channel over here in the Bavona household, and there's a lot
so
of...
So good. It's so good.
Oh, it's so good. So, you know, John can chime in here too, because we've been watching just a lot of just music documentaries. You know, the Freddie Mercury, The Great Pretender was on a couple months ago. We watched something on Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses. You know, there's such a wealth of information that if you're a moderate fan to a super fan, I think if you're a super fan, I think you can still get a lot out of watching a musical documentary, because you hear not just from the artist's perspective, but you hear from their contemporaries and you hear from, you know, sort of their management company as well. So you get a lot of different perspectives. So yeah, I think music documentaries have a lot to offer, and, you know, I really like them. So I think there's a market for them.
How about you, John? Sheila just dimed you out about being a fan of the Reels Channel docs, but as a musician also, do you get something out of watching these, or is it just like, yeah, I do that too all day. Like, I don't need to see a documentary about it.
Oh, no. Especially the music groups that I grew up watching. It's amazing to me to watch the rise. Unfortunately, a lot of them, the fall. A lot of these documentaries, it starts out with them at a young age, and then it goes up to a peak, and then the downfall of the artist. I see a lot of that formula in a lot of those documentaries. One thing I happen to really like about Laurel Canyon was it really wasn't that. It wasn't the rise and fall. You know, it was just a documentary about a place and time and a group of artists.
And despite the infidelities, like the dysfunction of the Mamas and the Papas, and Michelle Phillips just seeming to bone everyone in the canyon at some point, and the bands falling apart, but then, you know, new bands rising out of that in the ashes, and the racially diverse Love not being able to play in the South, and then their business management woes with Elektra Records, all of those bumps, it's not like a behind the scenes, like VH1, like we had in the 90s, where,
exactly,
you know, like going into the last commercial break and then the fall.
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
I completely agree with you. This was just, it was just what it was. And no one really even held a grudge, not to be too Woodstock peace and love about it. But it was kind of, at least the version that they're telling here, and they're using a lot of first-person accounts. So I had no reason to not believe it. You know, we had good days and we had bad days, and then we had good days again. Something would fall apart, but then out of that, something beautiful would come out of it. It seems much more like real life the way it's presented here. This documentary and Allison Elwood directing it, she takes the approach of, we're not getting a lot of one-on-one interviews. It's not like Talking Heads where she's sitting down with the guys who are alive. We're getting a lot of archival footage. We're seeing bands playing. We're seeing them, the 8mm video of them in their homes, while we get voiceovers of the people from the time talking about it. Did that keep you invested more, or would you have rather have seen more of a sit-down interview style?
You know, John and I were talking about this as we were watching it, and I said, I think one of the high points of this documentary is the fact that it's not a talking head, it's a narration. You're narrating the story of what you're watching through the lens of these old photographs from Henry Dilton, from Nuret Wild. You're seeing sort of the evolution of how Laurel Canyon came to be, as told by the people who are in these photos and videos. And for me, it preserves the sanctity of the moment by not seeing David Crosby 52 years removed from, you know, the time and place that they're talking about.
I agree with you. I don't need to see Bobby Krieger from The Doors in, you know, 2018 or 19. How about you, John? Do you agree with that? Were you more invested in it with the seeing the footage from the time with the voiceovers versus a sit-down interview?
I liked it like this. That would have been great also, but it would have been a different documentary. You know, this was more of an outside look on it. It didn't need that. It wasn't about, you know, it's the best way I could put it.
I think it's fascinating that they actually have so many of these people still alive. Probably maybe a testament to, sure, they did a lot of drugs, but maybe they didn't do the hardest drugs that were available that maybe their contemporaries would have done a couple of years later in the 70s.
Right.
It was kind of surprising that so many of them are still around to talk about it. It's shocking that David Crosby is still around. David Crosby still performs. You know, I don't know if it's a testament to that they have just lived long or the fact that they were just so young when this happened. I feel like it may be the latter. They were just kids, you know, sure, going and living together. Again, as a musician, I want your take on this. There's a section, the guys in Love are talking about signing with Elektra Records, which they were initially happy about because they were going to get to keep the publishing rights to their music.
And that's huge.
Right? And that's what they talk about. And Little Richard, of all people, there's this whole section about how they were big fans with Little Richard. It turned out that the Beatles, like little fanboys, used to chase around Little Richard, and the guys in Love found that really funny that they were such like sycophants. So they were really happy about the publishing rights, but then the flip side to that is they felt the record was produced really on the cheap, and then it goes into this whole real business thing, which sounds very dry, but I think the way they presented it was anything but dry, and they go this whole thing about trying to get the Doors signed by Elektra Records so that they could swap out kind of and go to MCA. Did that resonate with you as like a real concern, the money a record company will put into producing your record and the ownership rights? Was that useful to you to hear as a musician?
Yes. Things are a lot different today than they were back then, obviously. The whole business is much, much, much different today.
In a good or bad way, would you say? Or just different?
Financially, monetarily speaking, much worse today.
Really? Really? So meaning that artists see less of the money earned on their work than
these
guys?
Yeah.
Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, ever since the iTunes and the invention of the internet, the recorded media just faded away. Back then, you made a record, the record company would invest X amount of dollars in the production of the record. And then when the record went on sale, they would recoup that money. And then obviously the profit. Back then, people also bought records. Today, you know, you really don't have that. People buy one song on iTunes, maybe. The rest of the record just goes on the side.
I mean, the whole idea of an album, especially if it was a concept album, is just foreign, I think, to a lot of, especially kids growing up today. The idea of having a wall or having like a Dark Side of the Moon or having Pet Sounds or any kind of thematic work like that, or anything by Rush, you know, like 2112. You would never get that today because no one's going to sit there and consume that. So I feel you. I feel you on that.
Now, when was the last time you bought a complete work?
Whenever Tower Records was still open on Old Country Road.
Right, of course. Of course. So you just don't have that anymore. I actually feel bad for consumers today. There was something very special when I was a kid, and let's say I bought a Led Zeppelin record or something like that. You held it in your hand. You know, you looked at it. You looked at the artwork on it. You would take the record out of the cardboard and you would see pictures of your favorite band, or you would see the lyrics on it.
Just the idea of liner notes is
yeah.
And lyrics, hello.
Yeah, that's what I said, you know? Lyrics.
Yeah, having lyrics.
There was something really special about the first time you dropped a needle on an album, you know, on a 78, the first time you heard the the little popping. There is something magical about like movie. Have you ever guys seen the movie Almost Famous?
Oh yeah,
a long time ago.
That movie makes me extremely nostalgic for the age of albums. The whole idea of it just being this bygone era that you can buy vinyl now, but it's very hipsterish and trendy. Right.
Although Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon is still the number one selling vinyl album today. I learned that last year at the Christie's auction for David Gilmour's guitars.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, it's
they sell something like 65,000 albums a year now still with vinyl.
That's crazy.
But yeah, there is something very special about like holding a piece of music in your hand. If it's a record, a tape, a CD, you know, whatever, because we've kind of lived all of those, you know, genres. There's something very special about holding that tangibly in your hand, like a connection to your artist. And, you know, with Spotify and streaming, it's very disconnected.
That's the best way of putting it. Schiller's a disconnected.
Thank you, honey.
Yeah, you're welcome. There is a disconnect. You know, that's what I meant before when I feel bad for the consumer, even though they don't feel that way. They feel like, hey, I just have to pay 99 cents and I get the song I like and I don't have to worry about if the rest of the songs on the record aren't good, you know, or something like that. You know, I disagree.
It is a shame that people don't realize, because when I think back to probably my favorite tracks on albums, even still today, I'll listen to, I'm ashamed to admit, speaking to a musician, but I haven't paid for music in forever. I listen to pretty
much. Most people haven't.
I listen to pretty much on everything on Spotify, but sure. But I still listen to albums, though. I don't pull up, because I don't think that way. Like, I think in terms of albums still. It's just how I was raised, and so it's still how I think.
Sure.
So often, my favorite tracks are the ones that you never heard on the radio. The buried deep, the 9, 10, 11 track, or the
side Bs.
Yeah, or the fifth track, you know, the last one on side A before you would flip it. You know, like those are the tracks that always stand out to me.
God, we are showing our age.
Well, you know, well, because they were always the experimental ones, right?
Sure.
Those are the tracks that were, you know, you made tracks for the record company to release the singles, and then the artist made tracks to make themselves happy.
Right.
And I think a lot of times those are the ones that were the most interesting. I mentioned a little bit before, Laurel Canyon, this series, this two-part series, is actually not so much about Laurel Canyon as it is about the people who live there. And so Laurel Canyon acts more as like a backdrop that just tells a story that weaves from one person to another person, back to that first person, out to another person, like a snake. Sheila, watching it, what was one of your favorite dysfunctional moments?
To me, the way that this documentary was set up, it was like they weaved down the street. Like they just kind of stopped from house to house and they told the story of who was in that house. And you kind of like, you know, wove your way down Laurel Canyon Boulevard that way. You know, one of my favorite dysfunctional moments is one that I touched on earlier about like sort of the dissolution of the Byrds and how, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash and then Neil Young's kind of split with Stephen Stills from Buffalo Springfield. But yet, like, no hard feelings. It was just, hey, that wasn't working, but I'm going to still join Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. So how that band formed was, you know, part of the dysfunction and then the organicness of how things came about. And then Henry Diltz was the photographer for the album cover for Crosby, Stills, and Nash for their first one. And they found this, like, dilapidated house, and they took pictures. And then when they got the proofs back, they realized that they were sitting in the wrong order for the band.
I love that whole sequence.
That absolutely,
so hard.
It just, like, I was just like, that is just the quintessential moment for me for this installment of this show. And they wanted to go back the next day when they realized what they'd done and take the picture over. But as they got there, the house was being bulldozed. Like, what a, you know, moment in time. Like, you're never going to believe this kind of a story. So that was, for me, that was like my favorite kind of, you know, dysfunctional, funny moment.
How about you, John? Looking back over this first episode, one of the dysfunctional parts stood out to you as either the most interesting or the most enjoyable from a schadenfreude laughing at other people's miseries kind of way?
To be honest, how much pot they smoked and still were able to write and sing and play in tune. And the partying, the drinking, and the sex, and the drugs, and all that, you know, it didn't stop them from writing so much great music.
David Crosby says at one point, if you wanted your brains to liquefy and come out of your nose, all you had to do was come over to his house, listen to Joni Mitchell sing while you smoked his pot, because he had the strongest pot on the block.
And
he talked about your brain melting out of your head. That's
right.
That's graphic, and I totally, completely believe every word of what he was saying. All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. Johnny Eccles from Love refers to this pretty early on, that Laurel Canyon was like Oz. He talks about how it was this place that you didn't live there because it was hip. These people all lived there before Laurel Canyon was a scene. But he says it was cheap. That's why they lived there. But it grew into this arts community, and he refers to it as Oz. And since Oz is this fictional fantasy land, I'm going to give you your shot, John. You get to pick you and for three people to form a jam band with from the Laurel Canyon gang that we see here. Well, who are you signing up to sing and play with?
Wow.
It doesn't have to be three, but you can't have more than three.
Obviously.
Damn, Mike, this is his first time out. Be nice.
This is the hard-hitting stuff you get at the clubhouse, John. Then we take out the pugil sticks and we beat you next.
Of course, listen, I'm a guitar player, so I have to say Hendrix. Definitely. But there's other sides to me, you know, than just being a guitar player. You know, I'm a songwriter as well. So any of the, as I said before, the Crosby, Stills, and Nash stuff, the Jackson Browne part was fantastic. So again, I can't make one band. I'm sorry.
Whose house do you want to wander into and sit down and play guitar with? Maybe it's Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Bavona. You know, maybe you threw a deal out and, you know, fuck you, Neil Young. And
I can't sing as well as those guys.
But you're a way better guitar player. Just saying.
Maybe if Zappa was there. Probably like Zappa.
I love it. How about you, Sheila? Let me put you on the hot seat too. I'll get a little tit for tat here. If you had to jam with any of these people, or not if you didn't want to jam with them, you just wanted to pick them out to play a private concert in your living room, which not more than three are you picking to play for you?
Oh, well, my little girl heart is going to have to go for the Monkees. I would say probably Mickey Dolenz, because I love the Monkees. I was a big fan of the Monkees when they came out. When we first got cable, Nickelodeon was a big thing, and they were on Nickelodeon a lot. Got a lot of the Monkee love. So I'd say Mickey Dolenz.
I used to watch that, too, when I was a kid.
I love Graham Nash. I love the Hollies. I love his voice. So I would say Graham Nash. Jim Morrison. Hell yeah. He can sing me the phone book. Granted, you know, he died at 27, but if he were, you know, existentially still here.
I love Nurit Wilde's comment about Jim Morrison. She was just like, yeah, he was a good guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's so almost fictionalized in the way we treat him and talk about him, you know, and not in Small Heart because of the movie with Val Kilmer and stuff. But he almost seems like a mythical creature to us now in 2020.
Right.
And so for someone that knew him and knew him well and just be like, yeah, he was a good guy and he was extremely charismatic. I love hearing that because he doesn't really have a reputation for good guy.
And they didn't sugarcoat him either in this. You know, when Love was talking about trying to get Elektra to sign the Doors, they brought the record execs down and, like, you know, the Doors crashed and burned because Jim Morrison was drunk, but they said, give him a second chance. And then the quote that I wrote down was that Jim was incandescent and burning in the second performance because he was just on. And like that, I was like, that I am here for.
Right. It's the Babe Ruth of music, you know.
Yeah. He was also the earlier versions of the bad boy frontman, you know, prior to the Steven Tylers or, you know, anyone like that, you know, he kind of created that persona.
You're 100% right. I mean, Alice Cooper comes into this doc right after this and he's like, oh, you know, Jim was, you know, Jim wanted to be this bad boy, but, you know, people still liked him. You know, I filled this role of villain and that was the part I played. Dude. I mean, Jim Morrison was arrested on the regs for public lewdness and vulgarity in his lyrics and the Ed
public
Sullivan
nudity.
Thing. Yeah, and public intoxication. I mean, he broke every vice law probably known to man. He is the first bad boy, and you're 100% right. Steven Tyler is clearly Mick Jagger to a certain point. I mean, all in that mode, I think. Mm-hmm. They all owe a lot of their frontman swagger to the Jim Morrison of the world.
All right, Mike, what about you? Who are your three?
It's not so easy, is it?
Do we get to do this for episode two as well? Because I have different answers.
Well, yeah, sure. Because, you know, episode one leaves us at the end of the 60s is the way it looks like it's set up.
Yeah, it ends with Woodstock.
You know, the world is about to change kind of thing. And Vietnam really, Vietnam had started, but Vietnam hadn't really become a thing yet. So, right. You know, part two is gonna be a different kind of world for our Laurel Canyon fans. For my three, I'm probably going to go with Robbie and Ray from The Doors.
Nice.
I'm a big Doors fan. Who do I want to sing to me? I think I'm going to take The Byrds as a whole.
Oh, nice.
So I'm going to take The Byrds as a whole with Robbie and Ray playing backup with them. So I guess I took five, but it's my show. So, you know, fuck you. I can do what I want.
You can make the rules.
I can do what I want.
Then I'm going to put Peter Tork in as well.
All right.
The funny thing is, you can't go wrong.
Right?
You can't go wrong. There
really
is no wrong answer.
No.
Here, you can throw three darts and you can have a masterclass in music. And it's so funny because they were so, so high. So we're just about the end of episode one of Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time. So now I want you guys to give people listening the 30-second elevator pitch on whether they should or shouldn't watch this show. Sheila, as the veteran Pod Clubhouse voice here.
Oh my God, I'm a veteran.
More than John. So so give me your 30, or give the listeners your 30-second elevator pitch on why they should or should not watch Laurel Canyon.
Definitely, this is something that if you are a fan of music, this is something you should definitely check out. The interconnectedness of this area, this place and time, you know, the organicness of how the collaborations happened, how the influences developed. Just as a fan of music, I think it's an important time in music for where music went after this, you know, the plug-in, the electrifiedness of the arena rock that kind of grew from this movement. Also, you know, this is music that we hear on the radio still. We're 50 years removed from this documentary. So it's recent history. It's still played. John has been teaching at home because he can't go out and teach. And he's been teaching to one of his students on the regular California Dreaming. So I have been singing this song for weeks and weeks and weeks in my head. You know, it's all still very relevant.
I like it. All right, John, you're up. Give me your professional musician elevator pitch on why someone should or should not watch Laurel Canyon, A Place in Time.
I really, really enjoyed it. I'm going to go back to what I said at the beginning. You take a place where every house is an artist. And all they used to do was go from one house to the other and write music. And then at night, they would go see each other's acts. That was another thing. They all supported each other. They worked together. They played together. If you're an artist, if you're a musician, or even if you're not, you're going to find watching this to be extremely influential. And you're going to find yourself wishing that you lived then and there in Laurel Canyon, that you got to experience life like they lived it.
I completely agree. I think this is a real slice of a time where you really get to be a fly on the wall because of Pop Culture Review and Pod Clubhouse. I watch a lot of documentaries. I watch a lot of people attempting to capture a time and a place. And this is definitely one of the better ones I have seen. I really felt like I was there. I felt immersed in the world. And it's not a world I know well, but I was so engrossed by what I saw, what I heard. It was hitting all of my senses in the best way possible constantly. For me, this is a total win. You guys should definitely, May 31st at 10 p.m., go check out Laurel Canyon Part 1. And then June 7th, Part 2 airs at 10 p.m. That's going to do it for us for Part 1. Stay tuned, because a week after this comes out, Part 2 will come out. Sheila and John, thank you guys so much for being here tonight to discuss Part 1 of Laurel Canyon. And I hope you guys come back for Part 2.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we're not going to scare you off. My questions weren't too hard. You'll be back for Part 2?
I'll be back. Hopefully my lovely wife will be here as well.
I will, definitely.
I like how she left us hanging there for a second.
Yeah. I got a little worried there.
I got to make you guys sweat.
All right, guys. Thank you guys so much. Thank you guys for listening. This has been Pod Clubhouse Film Reviews talking about Laurel Canyon Part 1. Like I said, stay tuned for Part 2 in a couple days. Take care. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse!